This week's episode of the Autoblog Podcast is brought to you by the Autoblog Daily Digest. It's a great way to stay updated with what's happening in the world of cars in just 2 or 3 minutes every day. Ask your smart speaker for the Autoblog Daily Digest to stay up to speed with the latest car news, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. Joining me today on the show is Road Test Editor Zach Palmer and West Coast Editor James Ryswick. Guys, it's a gorgeous sunny afternoon here in Michigan. Not sure how it is out there in Oregon, but how are we doing? How you doing, Zach?
I'm doing good over here. Just like you said, it's spring, finally, both officially and actually outside. So I don't know if it's still raining over there in Oregon. I know that seems to happen all year long, but weather, James.
Yeah, well, I have my parents visiting me from Arizona right now, and they're always like, oh no, it's gonna rain soon. Oh no, it might rain later. Okay, it might rain. We're like, dude, we don't even notice. It's just going to sprinkle a bit. If you didn't do things because it might sprinkle a bit, you're never going to do anything. It's just misting. It's fine. You can do things.
We're like supposed to get like torrential downpour tonight, apparently. I did not know this, but I got an alert on my phone. So we'll see. Anyways, Autoblog Podcast listeners, I'm sure you do not care about the weather around our
weathercast,
our estates, right? But it's a good day to drive a sports car, which we'll get to at the end. Spend my money. We're going to help somebody maybe replace an 01 S2000. We'll talk about that more. Good spend my money. It's a two-car question, which is cool. We have an update from a couple podcasts ago. Zach gave some sage advice about buying a Lyft, so we'll get into that a little bit. And then we've been driving some cool stuff. Right off the top, Zach drove the Tacoma TRD off-road. James has been in a Mini Cooper, a 4 Series, and a Corvette. So we're just going to kind of shuffle the deck and talk about those. And I have another update on the Chevy Suburban Diesel, which I appear to be getting into on a quarterly basis. And I am totally okay with that. It's awesome in many ways. We'll run through some news. Toyota 86 is reportedly delayed. The headline is to differentiate it from Subaru BRZ. Interesting on that one. We'll see. I wrote an opinion piece this week on why Stellantis needs Chrysler. It's spurred a lot of different discussions in a lot of different directions. So I'm actually mainly just curious to hear what you guys think about that, if Stellantis needs Chrysler. And we'll keep it in the company formerly known as FCA, and then talk about the Jeep Magneto. What a name. Can these guys, I mean, what is it with Stellantis and names and like everything is a little weird with them, and that's fine. And yeah, again, we'll spend some money. So tell me about this Tacoma. All I know about it so far, Zach, is that it's like kind of army green. I don't know if it's the precise army green, but it's also lifted and it looks pretty awesome from the pictures you've been dropping. What have you done with it? Tell me you've gotten some dirt and gravel on it.
I have got some dirt and gravel on it. Yes, it is the Toyota Tacoma TRD off-road. So that's the middling of the TRD family, above the Sport, below the Pro. But honestly, how it's equipped, it's much closer to the Pro than any regular off-road is. As you mentioned there, it is lifted. So it has the official TRD lift kit on it that brings it up 2 inches in the front, 1 inch in the back. In case you're wondering, it does not have any sort of squat going on with it. It still looks plenty level. But in addition to that, it also has the TRD skid plate that you get on the Pro and the TRD exhaust that you get on the Pro as well. So it's, you know, it's getting there. It doesn't have the Fox internal bypass shocks from that truck. You know, that's one big item that is still missing off the list. But I took it on some dirt roads. I took it down, found this new one track actually that I had never found before off this seemingly deserted dirt road, and drove it over some berms, found some very tall things that I wouldn't want to drive non-lifted truck over, which was fun, actually. And I didn't get to push it or anything. It would need to go to an actual off-road park for that. But, you know, I've had some fun within the confines of what the countryside of Southeast Michigan has to offer. The actual kit that's on this, the lift, you can apply to any sort of 2020 or newer taco, and it's $1,350. The coolest thing about it, though, to me, like beyond just the actual lift, is you get a new grill and a new safety sensing sort of plate that allows you to keep all of the Toyota safety sensing equipment on there. So unlike pretty much every other aftermarket lift that you might apply out there, this retains the adaptive cruise control, automatic emergency braking. All of your driver assistance stuff stays with it, which is pretty cool. One slight disappointment is instead of actually just readjusting and re-aiming the fog lights, they take them completely out, and you just lose your fogs, which is sort of a weird thing, but it is part of the package. I mean, overall, it is good and bad as far as what I think it does to the truck on the road. One thing that I really like when I drive tacos is, you know, that agile-ish feeling to them, because they're a mid-sized truck, so they feel smaller on the road than, say, like a Tundra or F-150. Lifting it makes it feel, it sways a bit more than before. It, you know, that the handling definitely takes a hit. You know, if you're lifting a truck, you might not really care about those things. It just makes it a little bit more ungainly to drive around, which, you know, that's a decision that you'll have to make if you want to lift it or not. But overall, you know, it's a Tacoma. Everything else about it is the same. 3.5 liter V6. The exhaust sounds okay. It's not that loud. Drones a little bit. I still have a few more days with it. I am looking forward to hopefully driving over some more things, finding some more off-road areas to take it to. And just like you said off the top, Army Green. I love looking at it too.
The TikTok you did that dropped in one of our Slack channels, I got a good look at this thing. Looks awesome. I'm not sure how I'd feel about having the fog lights gone. Probably in like real practical application wouldn't really be the end of the world, but it's just kind of an odd thing. But just the lift really gives it very cool off-road, kind of a tough look. I think that's great. It's the exact right color, for sure. I thought I saw this somewhere. I'm curious if this is true. This is your first time driving a Tacoma, is that right?
Yeah, so I drove one like to lunch and back, which I don't really count as like actually driving it. I got like a small feel of it, but this is the first time actually, you know, any good amount of time behind the wheel, getting a feel of it. Trying to figure out why more people buy this thing than every other mid-sized truck by a long shot, which I mean, a lot of it just has to do with the reputation of it. It's going to last forever, and it's going to hold its value too. You know, you can tell that it's one of those Toyota trucks that are just going to drive until the end of time. As long as you can put gas in it, it's going to keep on trucking along.
I'm a big fan of the Tacoma. Metrically, I think it falls short in many areas. If you judge it, you know, if you compare it to some of the other things in the segment, but just emotionally, it's a truck that whenever I would get one through the fleet, very excited to drive it, very excited to get it. Usually I find myself motivated to write something in a way that other trucks in the segment don't quite have that visceral appeal, if you will. James, what do you think of the Tacoma? Throw it around to you.
Yeah, I kind of agree, specifically in terms of the general segment, that you know, the interior is pretty compromised by how short it is. Really weird driving position, and kind of, it's just not as useful day to day as a Ranger or the Colorado. But it nevertheless is very cool, and To speak, I want to go to the Army Green point, because that was, for the Forerunner, that was its TRD Pro color for last year. Every single year, the TRD Pro Forerunner gets a unique color. So it was like Voodoo Blue 2 years ago. It was Army Green last year, and it's like Lunar Rock, which is this pale green. And every year it gets a new one. Well, Army Green was like wildly popular, and everybody loved it. And people were definitely just buying the TRD Pro just for the damn color. Even though they didn't need the $53,000 Forerunner or however much it is. But for this year, Army Green is now available on the new Trail Edition, which is an SR5 with some darked out trim and wheels, a Yakima roof rack on it, and an included cooler. Hey, and that's the car I have right now. It's not Army Green. It's kind of this battleship gray, but nevertheless. So now you can get that color at a much lower price. So applaud Toyota for doing that, because it's a really cool color. And I find that more interesting than the Tacoma itself, honestly, because I'm more of a 4Runner guy.
So I would agree with that sentiment. I would take the 4Runner over the Tacoma, and I would actually take the 4Runner over almost anything. I am just a big 4Runner fanboy. I just really like not everything about it. There's things about it that are almost undrivable, but I'm just a big fan of the overall vehicle. It's just got the right vibe for me.
In the world of Army Green, I drove a Tundra TRD Pro a year ago that also was Army Green. So they're spreading it all around the Toyota pickup lineup, which, yes, they absolutely should, because it is 100% the best color. Like I said in my TikTok, actually.
I remember that truck came through, and like, I love that one. I feel like that one this is probably back when we were like trading cars. Yeah, that was awesome. I remember I had a chance to take it. I think we had like a Cadillac in the fleet too. And I think you even asked me, Zach, you were like, which one do you want? And I forget if I was at home or something. I may even be misremembering this, but I asked my wife, I was like, which one do you want? You know, what are we going to do this weekend? She was like, oh, get that Tundra. That was awesome. And it just was. It was just this, like, you know, certainly the Tundra is not in the top probably three of the pickup truck rankings, but it's still a big, fun truck. And when you do it in Army Green, who doesn't want to do that, right? That's fun.
More things need to be green. I think that's just, once again, more things need to be green.
I am thinking of planting a garden shortly. Normally I wait a month, but why not? It's literally like close to 70 right now. I'm wasting a month of basically spring here. Time to get some mulch in the ground.
I was referring to cars, just by things, not just generally, like, you know, all things. But, you know, cool.
I tell you what, that was just like to throw things off the rails here a little bit. What about this Mini Cooper you're rolling around in? I have a Countryman in my driveway, and I haven't driven it much yet, so I have really no thoughts. But it's been a while since I have driven a Mini, so I'm quite excited, to be honest. You're in the Cooper S, or you were in the Cooper S. How'd that go?
Well, to that end, like, this is the first real Mini I've driven since 2014. And by real Mini, I mean no Countryman, no Clubman, no four-door, no whatever the hell the Paceman was, an actual Mini, a Mini Mini, which is now called the two-door hardtop. But it's the Mini. Like, I own a Mini. If you say I own a Mini, I don't think anyone's really thinking, oh, you own a Countryman S all four. You own a two-door Mini. And furthermore, it had a manual transmission. And I have to go back probably into like into the 2000s to the last time I drove one with an actual manual. And it was phenomenal. The magic is still there. It's still it's such a fun little car. The modern car, you know, it has like 189 horsepower over 200 pound feet of torque. Which is almost the exact same number as the 98 Z3 I'm sitting in presently, except this is rear-wheel drive, and that's front-wheel drive. And hello, torque steer. That thing is nuts. You do not need that much power in that car. Like, in fact, I probably wouldn't get it. It's just kind of needlessly nutty. But it is tremendously fun. The magic of that car remains. And it feels very familiar. Now, my wife had an original reborn Mini, so an 05 Cooper S. It was the darker electric blue color inside and out. Really cool car. I love driving that car. And although this one's probably a little more closer to the second generation, which went turbo and was built to a higher standard and a little more comfortable, nevertheless, it feels very familiar. That's great. The downside is that it feels way too familiar, and at this point feels pretty stale. Like, the Mini was like a very cool car, and like enthusiasts wanted one, and the general public wanted one, and that's rare, really. But it seems like it's just kind of faded away. We don't really think of the Mini anymore. Maybe I'm wrong in that, but it sure doesn't seem to be on my radar, on our general radar. And I think that's sad. And part of that, I think, is because BMW/Mini has been focusing so much on expanding the brand and maintaining the loyalty of people, which is a worthy thing, because if you have, you know, my wife owned one in 2005 when she was single. Well, she couldn't keep that size of car for long. So, you know, just like you outgrow it, so you want to keep people in the family. That makes total sense. But in the process of doing that, it seems like they've kind of stopped innovating with the thing that makes Mini a Mini, which is the Mini, which is the two-door hardtop. And it's just not as exciting as it once was. You know, it's doesn't look as good as it used to. Part of that has to do with pedestrian detection, pedestrian protection. You have to make the front end blunter, which will limit its cuteness, yada yada. But it's just not as fun and desirable. You look at the configurator. Back in the day, you used to be able to put like Puerto Rican flag stickers on the top and like different all sorts of different accessories, and the color palette was more interesting. And you look now, it's just not as customizable. And that really was Mini's thing. So it was kind of like, it was a little bittersweet, because although it was like really wonderful to get into a Mini again, I know a new one's coming, and I really hope it's special and kind of moves Mini forward, because it's a little too stuck into, not even retro to the 60s now, it's kind of retro to what it's been since like 09. And that's not good.
Yeah, you don't want to be unintentionally retro, if you will. Yeah. Like, the 90s sort of came back. Like, I noticed a lot of people are wearing like the baggy like starter sweatshirts again, and somehow that's cool. I don't subscribe to that. But there's certain eras that it takes a while to come back to, and it sounds like Mini is languishing in...
You just get stuck. It's like,
yeah.
It's the problem with one problem is retro design, because once you go back, where do you go from there? Like, you can't move on. That's the general theory. However, look at the Jeep Wrangler, look at the Porsche 911, look at the Range Rover, look at like all of a lot of British stuff actually. But you do have examples where a brand has managed to stay retro, keep that aesthetic, but move the ball forward enough. The Mustang, for instance. Look at the Dodge Challenger. I mean, that thing has changed once since what?
Yeah.
08, 09? But Dodge has come out with different colors every year. They've come up with some sort of different performance version to keep things fresh. Mini tries with, you know, like its Oxford edition or the Mayfair edition, but I don't think that's really enough to get people interested. It's just not enough. And maybe ultimately a small two-door subcompact car in 2021 isn't going to matter unless it's powered solely by electricity. And there is an SE, but even then, and I'd I don't know. Maybe it's hopeless, but I again, kind of bittersweet with the Mini this week.
That's an interesting take. Go ahead, Zach.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, one of the bigger hurdles I'd have, you know, if I was out there looking for, you know, a fun little enthusiast two-door, you know, you can buy this two-door hardtop S, which yours was probably around, like, 30,000, maybe, like, low 30,000, right? $35,000. Or you could hop on over to your Honda dealer and buy yourself a Honda Civic Si, which arguably very similar performance, very similar, you know, it's not the exact same driving feel, but still very competent enthusiast car for about 26 grand. You can get a GTI for way under that too. That thing has four doors. You know, that's really like the big hurdle for me with a lot of Minis is just the price. They drive so well. They're so fun. But, you know, it used to be like you could option them up like crazy with all of the customization options. Like you said, James, that was one of my favorite things to do as a kid, actually, was hop on the Mini configurator and just go nuts with it because you could do anything. To your point, you can't do that anymore. The cars are still crazy expensive, and there are alternatives that are cheaper. And, you know, I will say most of the time, you know, if you buy a Mini, it's because you're a Mini enthusiast. You don't necessarily, you know, you're not out there cross-shopping the Mini with all of these other cars. You buy it because you're like, I love Minis, I want a Mini, and you're not really considering other options. Yeah. Because if you do, you're probably going to walk out with something else.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. The other thing is, like, the interior, I like quirk. So, like, it's fun that there's circles everywhere and there's toggle switches. But this also, like, and this has been the case from the beginning of this generation, but it is kind of shoehorning new BMW stuff into the box of an old Mini kind of thing. Like, it's literally a square peg in a round hole. Like, literally the square rectangular touchscreen in a circular hole. What, like, no one thought that looked ridiculous. And then, so that at least that's a touchscreen. Because they have effectively an iDrive unit on the center console. Except it's like at your hip and beyond the handbrake. Like, you're never going to use it. So and that so you just have all this junk everywhere, like all this stuff, this electronic stuff that you're just like, I just want to change the channel while I'm driving, please. It just feels very like retroactively applied, even though it's a lot of the stuff's been there for the beginning. And you know, it's kind of like sometimes with enthusiast cars, like the simpler the better, please. Like, if I get into, like, a Miata, I kind of want a base one. Because once you get into, like, even just the second trim level up, you do have that center console knob. And it's just, it gets in the way. It's poorly placed. You get into, like, a Z4. And they're just all the fancy modernity that you enjoy in a regular drive everyday car just seems so wasted and, like, excessive in what is effectively a weekend car. Like, an enthusiast car can be that. And, you know, I'm sitting in this Mini and, like, the touchscreen is so complicated. I'm like, you know what? I would just rather have, like, an 06 with the plain old radio faceplate and give me a iPhone holder somewhere in the car. Like, I'd much rather have that than this overly complicated system in this car. And if that makes me sound like Grandpa yelling at a cloud, then... Oh well, but it could definitely be better integrated than it is in the Mini, all the tech.
I'm going to date myself, but you guys remember the openometer or whatever that thing was called that showed you how long the roof was open? That was Mini tech that was clever and like, functional is probably not the right word, but it was very on brand. Like, give me more of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's like fun stuff. Like Mini has always had like funny, goofy stuff. And there's always going to be humbuggers out there who are like, who roll their eyes at it and want, like, don't want anything to do with it. Like, for, like, the openometer that would keep track of the amount of time you're driving with the roof down. When my wife got her car in 05, Mini sent her like this big packet of just like fun promotional materials, really for no other reason than just like because it was fun to kind of just make your brand experience enjoyable. My sister-in-law also had a Mini, and she had the special version where there was this hidden button in the back of one of the gloves, because there was two glove boxes, and one of them, you press this button, and this cacophony of characters were in the car with you. Seriously. Like, you would gun the engine, and, like, you'd, like, this, all British, would, like, this guy from the engine room comes up and says, "Here we go!" or something like that. Like, they were always piping up to the point that it could get annoying, and you can shut it off. But it's this, like, super quirky thing. They're out there. It was the Camden edition. There was the Mayfair and the Camden edition, and they had these. And it's like such a, that will never show up on, you know, a standard features list or options. Is everyone really going to pay extra for that? Does Mini get a benefit from that? No, but it was fun. And so that's the good thing about Mini. And you wonder, like, is some of that really lost? Has the bean counters been like, "Nah, didn't matter. We don't need that anymore." So it's a brand of such promise and such fun. And I really hope that the next one, they kind of keep that fun, keep that quirk, but still, like, let's move on a bit here. Like, we do need to kind of do what they did with the Mustang, I'd say, as a good guide.
So it's interesting you bring up the Mustang, and you also, I think, mentioned Challenger earlier. And those are two examples, I think, of using nostalgia to, like, rebuild the brand. In this case, it's a specific model line. The Mustang has gotten a little bit different every year since, geez, what was it, 04, when they went full-on retro again. But they've really evolved it. It's been getting, like, I'd say, sleeker, more, you know, I almost see some, like, aeronautical themes in there. It's, like, really getting styled up. It does get different every 1.5 to 3 years in some way. Challenger got one slight change a few years back, and otherwise it's like the same looking Challenger that we saw when I feel like Dieter Zesche revealed the car in Detroit back in like 05, I want to say, something like that. It was so long ago. He did it with, like, geez, I forget who it was. It was like a network TV star got out of the car and did this kind of song and dance with them, and I'm remembering half the details. It's just that long ago. Point being, it's the same car. I feel like in some ways they've gotten away with that just because the market kind of found them. You know, they've tweaked the Charger more than they've tweaked the Challenger. And they've sort of let the Challenger almost become like a 911. You know, to go back historically, there never really was any changes for the Challenger. There was the first generation, and then that was it. There was that 1980s little thing that I don't know if you count that as a Challenger or not. I actually knew a guy in high school who had one and loved it. But there was never any real, like, generational continuation of the original Challenger. So now they're just living with this, like, you know, modern one that, like I said, is kind of the audience found it. I think maybe they accidentally found it. If you had asked me 15 years ago, 10 years ago, would the Challenger have lasted this long? I would have said no. I would have thought it was more like a Dodge Magnum or something that was here for a while and then went away, you know? Sort of like how Ford cycles through the different Mustang trims and models. But obviously I didn't see the future too well, and, you know, the car is endured. And I think with Mini, they haven't found their audience exactly, and the audience hasn't quite come back to them. I thought there was an opportunity maybe, 10 years ago when fuel prices were insane, that get a Mini. You know, it's a small car. They're reasonably fuel efficient. That could be a good thing for them. That never seemed to work. In the United States, there was a brief sort of pivot to smaller vehicles. Remember, we thought the Fiesta was going to save Ford for like a minute, and that didn't happen. And now they don't even make cars. It seemed like there were little, like, you know, brief periods in time where they had opportunities and just never quite, maybe because they don't lack the scale to really heavily invest and make a big bet and make it pay off. But I don't know, long story short, you've given me a lot to think about when I get in this Countryman tonight or tomorrow and ponder the future of the Mini brand. So, yeah. How about we talk about the 4 Series? Keep it in the BMW corporate hierarchy.
Sure.
How about the grill? Let's start there.
Oh, God. Well, it's interesting. Actually, I see the two actually as a bit related. Like, with, like, Mini, they seem to be so worried about Mini loyalists and keeping them in the fold by creating all these different versions, Countryman, Clubman, four-door Mini. Like, let's keep these loyalists, let's take care of them, and kind of lost the ball in terms of getting new people. BMW, on the hand, clearly does not care about making all the people who love them, including me, who is sitting in a 23-year-old BMW as I speak, not disgusting them with just ghastly grills and just not really heeding complaints about steering and the fact that we would like the cars to be perhaps as dynamic to drive as they once were. You know, they had that OK Boomer commercial where they basically said that if you don't think that the BMW iX electric crossover is the greatest thing since sliced bread, you're a crotchety old boomer. Okay, well, I'm 37 years old. I missed the baby boom generation by a few years, and I think that thing's kind of ugly. I also think the 4 Series from the front is pretty darn ugly, and it would prevent me from buying that car, even though a two-door luxury coupe is kind of my favorite type of car. The fact that it's not offered with a manual transmission, not really a fan of that either. So, you know, I understand that in order to attract new people, you have to do, you know, maybe bolder things and offer, you know, you have to make sure you have a great automatic transmission, and you have to make sure you have all the latest tech and all the greatest things that people now expect. Fully acknowledge that. But I don't quite get the almost open, sometimes animosity towards people who kind of like the brand in the past. And it seems a little weird to me that you can't do a better job of doing both. It's like they kind of both Mini and BMW need to be a little less extreme in the way that they're going about their brand positioning. So
it's interesting you say that. I think BMW used to have really great ads for the 3 Series. They were borderline like greatest hits clips in a way that only BMW could do with the 3 Series. And they were the most like over the top, to their base sort of thing, almost to the point of being like really like schmaltzy and syrupy, like in a way you would expect like, you know, baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet to do. And even Chevy doesn't do that anymore. But they were great ads, I thought. They used to run during when Mad Men was actually on the air. It would be like a BMW commercial, a Heineken commercial, and then back to the show or something. And they were all very good ads, naturally, as you'd expect to be during that show. So it's interesting they've pivoted, you know, to this, you know, again, confrontational sort of approach. It's good to be aggressive, and in advertising, if you're talking about it, that means you're probably succeeding to some extent. But still, the vibe that BMW has been putting out towards some of its existing base is weird. My only thought is that the grill isn't as bad as some people think it is. I just keep going back to it. I see a little bit of a 1930s look to it, if you will, and maybe that's me wanting to see it. I don't know if that's anything they've even sort of, you know, ascribed to the look, but you know, I'm okay with it, you know. But that's my only real take on it, is that it's not as bad as some people think. Did you do anything fun with the 4 Series that they want you to do?
I drove it with great dynamism at okay. points.
Please don't put dynamism in your story. please don't do that.
And you know, it's an enjoyable, and it was the 4-cylinder. And it sounds actually pretty cool. I'm hoping that it was and it's the engine I'm hearing. I hope it's not just piped through the speakers. That would be a bit sad, but it does sound you know, pretty cool. Again, I wish it had a manual. You know, I don't get why they can't just, like, BMW still sells a fair number of manual transmissions. You still can get it in the M4 and the M3. I mean, I just don't get why they can't throw a bone to enthusiasts. I don't understand that. Even if it's just like a special order option, right? Like, I'd happily, no matter what car I bought, right? I wouldn't mind having I'd happily special order a car. It's not that hard to do. But yeah, I should mention the ad I'm referring to earlier was this ad for BMW. It's very long. It's like minutes long. And it's this conversation between the iX Electric and the Bangle Butt BMW 7 Series. And it's this bizarre commercial. So for the first like half of it, effectively the iX is making fun of the 7 Series. Like, and effectively, like, all the people who like old BMWs. And it's just, like, going on and on and on. There's even coarse language at parts, which is weird. And then the 7 Series is, like this Wilfred Brimley-sounding gravelly guy who just is, like, old man in a cloud. Like, even going beyond anything we have said before, just with technology, yada, yada. And then, like, but by the time you get to the punchline, effectively, of, well, actually, we should all get together and appreciate the past as well as the future, it's like 3 minutes in, and it just seems like BMW is berating what it used to be. Which is also weird, because it's the Bangle Butt 7 Series, which is kind of a reviled car amongst BMW fans. So, it's this bizarre commercial, and... I guess I'd recommend looking at it, because it's just like, what are you trying to accomplish with this, BMW? Like, who are you talking to here? I don't understand it.
They're just being intentionally edgy, and that is like their strategy. I don't know if you saw the commercial for the M Performance parts for the new M3 and M4, but it's a similar vibe where it starts out okay, and then as you start to get into it, as the car actually comes on screen, you go into some like insane action scenes with the driver essentially just screaming their full head off as they're like drifting through this parking structure. And then it cuts to a dude with a chainsaw cutting through a chain link fence, and he's screaming while he's doing that. And it just, the last 45 seconds to a full minute of this like 2 minute commercial is just screaming. There's a little bit of engine noise in there, just a little bit for the M3, M4. But it's mostly just like trying to be extremely edgy and like young and hip. And I don't know, like the people that can afford that car are not, you know, they're not appealing to that audience. Like if you're trying to appeal to like some 20-year-old or something who thinks this is cool, like they don't have $80,000 to go buy your new M4. Like I don't know. It just it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me either. I'm totally with you there, James.
I'm just confused. You know, I don't get it.
So in any other podcast, this would have been the headliner. I guess any other podcast, maybe last year, but you had the Corvette, new Stingray. What's up with that?
Well, you often ask what interesting things did you do with it? And often my answer is, well, I drove it for 75 miles on a designated test loop. And then I came home because I work from home and there's a pandemic. It's not that interesting. But with the Corvette,
this was
interesting.
That's exactly what I do with every press car, too, I'll say. But go on.
Yeah. You're really setting me up for failure. But in this case, I drove it. I drove it in the shadow of Mount St. Helens. And the very first time, I live in Portland, the very first time I came to Portland was in 2009, was for the Suzuki Kizashi press launch. How about that? And we ended up driving it on this really awesome, like, mountain road. And at one point, we ended up in this, like, the scenic viewpoint overlooking Mount St. Helens. And I've always kind of wanted to find it. I've looked on the map, couldn't really figure out exactly where it was. And so I was like, okay, I have the Corvette with winter tires on it. This is a key thing because I'm still driving into the mountains, and I'm going to try and find this road because it looks pretty interesting. And so, as described in my story, the road is spectacular. It follows like these three alpine-looking lakes. They're reservoirs, but nevertheless, gorgeous scenery. Great road, fantastic for no matter what you end up driving it on. But I eventually ran into a giant snow-covered road. And even with winter tires, I wasn't going to be that guy who got the bright orange Corvette stuck in the snow. So, was it the road that I was looking for? Was it the... Did I get to the scenic spot? I don't know, and no, I didn't. But maybe someday. And that was my story of the in the Corvette.
I think that you can put that one on Chevy for not giving you chains. You know?
Well, I think you just wrote the foreword to your memoirs, actually, right there. Yeah. Then you just trail off and go right into it. And, you know, then the postscript is where you wrap it all up and tell us the ending.
Any opportunity to bring the Kazushi, the Suzuki Kazashi back up again, like, why not? It's I have more than one great stories about that car. So
I love that car. We had a long-termer when I was at Auto Week. I took it all the time. I mean, it handled pretty good. It looked interesting. The interior was okay, actually. It was competitive with many... I mean, it was competitive with, like, the Ford Fusion at the time. Let me put it that way. I went to the local reveal of it, actually, in Detroit. So I remember the Kazashi quite well. It was very credible. The problem was there
Suzuki
was not
wasn't.
Nearly, yeah, and there wasn't nearly enough marketing money to, like, get people to know that this car was a thing out there and you could buy it. Yeah, I took it to a Michigan State game. I drove the Kazashi a lot.
My other kazoo story was the we went to a friend's wedding, but it wasn't known as a wedding. It was like a surprise thing. It was supposed to be an engagement party, but it turned out to be a wedding. So we're there. As it turns out, to the end, they didn't think that they were going to need a ride home. They didn't think like, oh, how are we going to get to the next thing of the evening? I was like, well, I could drive you. And my press car that evening, that's right, the long-term Suzuki Kazashi. So they drove, we had a 7 Series at the time. There were very lovely cars I could have signed out for this occasion. But nope, had the Kazashi. So that is forever imprinted in their lives, as I had the Kazushi.
I have the almost exact same story, but I'll see your Suzuki and raise you a Fiat 500. Which is where I was at a wedding in my earlier days. And I guess my now wife, or maybe we were married at the time, and then we had to take like a couple other people on the Fiat 500. It was like, well, who could drive? And I'm like, well, I've just been standing here all night, you know, not drinking anything. Sure. But here's the problem. I have a Fiat. It, like, you could literally see people visibly recoil like, oh, okay. All right. Let's get into that. But
Well, actually, you know, speaking of both Minis and Fiats, you know, people are always amazed at how much space is in that car. My father got into one for the first time the other day and was shocked. Hey, wow, this isn't that small. And, you know, my wife is 5 feet tall. There's a ton of space behind her in the Mini. You can fit 4 people in that car, including myself. Perfectly comfortable. And you have that great big window back there, big box. You have even the skylight overhead. So, yeah, better than the Fiat in that regard.
So I guess we need to really do a hard shift here and go from Minis and Fiat 500s to the Chevy Suburban, the troop transporter of North America. Yeah. I drove a Suburban, the Duramax diesel. I did a first drive on it last fall, and then through a weird sequence of events, it landed in my driveway again. And I had a lot of thoughts on it, actually. Perhaps the backstory is more interesting, that I was going to get, a Sierra, Zach, and that crashed or ran into some details. We don't need to get too into like the fleet.
Yeah,
drama.
No, it was gonna be an Escalade.
It's supposed to be an Escalade. Then, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was gonna be that, and then there was another GM full size SUV, yep. And they were like, nope. And there was a 370Z Nismo in there.
Not gonna work with a toddler. Yeah.
Yeah, and now we landed with a Suburban diesel.
Thank you. So. It's awesome. Like it's a enjoyable SUV, I think. It actually got me thinking about the Suburban nameplate and the fact that I think it does have, you know, it's got some history, it's got some lineage. I think in some ways, I think it's cooler than like a Yukon XL, and the fact that like the Suburban is like borderline anonymous, you know, it's like, you know, like the red flannel shirt of SUVs, you know, it's just been around forever. It's very utilitarian. Very functional. The interior is, I think, very good in the Suburban now, in a way that it didn't used to be. GM full-size SUVs always had, I thought, pretty mediocre interiors, and now this one's quite nice. The layout is way better, so that's obviously a good thing. You could put more things in the back. Same thing with the Tahoe. I think this like new generation of full-size SUVs is really in a good place for Chevy and for General Motors. I don't think I've actually driven any of the GMCs, but, you know, I don't know. I feel like there's something about the understated Chevy vibe of the Suburban that really resonated with me. I don't think I noticed it as much the first time because I was focusing on the Duramax diesel engine and, you know, all that torque you get. And of course, all the new things that are part of this, like, you know, seventh generation or whatever we're on here for the Suburban, but just kind of driving it for no real reason other than like three other cars fell through and I'd probably riff about it on the podcast. Just got the thoughts going and I was like, you know, I could see people who need a large SUV looking at this as opposed to some of the over the top, like just like looks and feel you get with the Yukon and the Yukon XL. So, and I mean, plus it's very capable and it's very expensive. The one I tested was 79 grand. So that's a luxury good by any account. I was more impressed with the Suburban than the Expedition the last time I drove it. I think the interior is a bit better in offering the diesel is an interesting choice. You know, the Ford exterior is good. The interior, I think, is a little bit less so. And it's tough because, you know, they've got the Navigator. And frankly, all Lincolns look pretty good. So they're in kind of a tough spot. And I think in Chevy's case, it was very just clean, nice. You know, this one had, if I recall, like brownish leather and just very attractive vehicle. So I would say, after the Suburban was in some ways an afterthought for me for many years, in some ways for a while, I think it was almost bad, like bad politics, bad publicity for GM to even be really publicizing some of these larger SUVs. I remember I went to one of their events and they were kind of like, well, this is all the things you could do with it. And they were almost like apologizing for making them. They were like, you know, we feel like people are asking us, what are you still making these things for? And then obviously now, people can't get enough SUVs in any shape or form. The larger, the better. But yeah, I like the Suburban, you know, I don't know. So.
Yeah, no, the diesel engine that GM is moving around to all these SUVs, I think is, you know, it's a really, really good engine for them because it's borderline. You don't even notice that it's a diesel and, you know, you get crazy fuel economy with it too. You know, that's the problem with, you know, all of the 5.3 liter and 6.2 liter V8s and the whole GM SUV lineup is you get, you know, I had an Escalade Sport Platinum 3-4 weeks ago now. Got about 15-16 miles per gallon throughout my week with it. And you know, you with that Suburban diesel, I bet that you were in the mid-20s.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's rated cruising at around 26 on the highway, 20 city. Yeah. I mean, that's not nothing. You know, it's impressive.
You can have have your cake and halfway eat it too.
They've done a nice job too with like the high country trim of making it look and feel fairly like aspirational, if you will. Like in many ways, I feel like, you know, Suburban is just kind of like this old truck SUV. Like I have this like picture of it in my head almost, because you don't even see that many of them, if you will, even around Metro Detroit. It's just, they don't like, it's not this huge volume vehicle. But to me, it's like, it offers you something, if you will. It's maybe I'm just getting older and I'm getting to the spot where I'd rather just wear like a, you know, I compare it to like, no matter if you're into watches, maybe you could wear an expensive watch strap, but give me a NATO strap because it's comfortable. That's the vibe I'm getting from the Suburban. So check out my story that ran way back in the fall, but we'll link to it in here if you're curious. Let me know. Check out James's road test Corvette that ran. When did that run? Like a month ago, James? A few weeks ago? I remember the pictures, but I don't remember when it ran.
It's all a blur. It's all a blur.
So Google Ryswick Corvette. You'll probably see two or three articles. Migliori Suburban, TRD Taco to come. And that is the car review section. We definitely went through chapter and verse on this one. We're at 50 minutes already, gentlemen. So let's run through some news here. Then we'll spend some money. All right, let's talk some news. We're hearing that the Toyota 86 reportedly is delayed. One of the reasons is to differentiate it from the Subaru BRZ. I'm going to toss it over to you, Zach. Quick reaction.
Yeah, so that's obviously news because these two have been twins for eternity since it was the FRS and the BRZ. The one bit of this that really sticks out to me, though, is them saying they want to give their car more power than the BRZ, which would, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of reason beyond styling to buy one over the other, some very subtle differences in styling. But if Toyota actually gives their version of it more power, you know, that's going to be a great reason to maybe spend like $500 or another $1,000 on the Toyota over the Subaru version. So maybe they end up doing that. If so, I'm pretty psyched because the engine in the old one was my, you know, one glaring problem with it. Beyond that, what a beautiful, affordable sports car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seemed hearing that and reading that sure made sense after talking with the chief engineer at the Supra launch about their relationship with Supra versus Z4 and their wanting to make sure that, you know, the car met his/their priorities. And he was also in charge of the last, the FRS 86 BRZ program. So I'm just assuming he's also of the current car. But either way, it sure makes sense that they'd want it to be their own Toyota thing and to make it as good as they think it can be, regardless of the shared parts bin that they were given to accomplish it. So that rang true with everything I reported during the Supra launch.
I think they're sort of taking learnings from their various sports car like tandems here and sort of just applying them across the board and seeing what works with, you know, BMW and, you know, the Supra arrangement, and then saying, well, okay, we have the BRZ and the FRS, now 86, how can we tweak that arrangement? I think that's just common sense. I think it does make a lot of good sense too for Toyota to differentiate the 86 with a little bit more power and then maybe let Subaru dial in on just dynamics, handling, Subaru things. Because, you know, I mean, when they launched, it didn't make a lot of sense why the cars were so close together, at least to car journalists. I mean, the whole dealer argument that, you know, different sports cars for different audiences and different showrooms. Okay, maybe. I don't know. I always thought they were, frankly, too close together. They were both quite good, mm-hmm. You know? I mean, it seemed like journalists tended to go towards the, probably the BRZ, just because it seems like there's a little bit of a, like, Subaru favoritism. People tend to like the brand of the business for whatever reason. That's just me kind of observing. I don't know if it was true or not. Scion was an interesting home for it. I think it makes more sense to give it the 86 badging, which has some pedigree, has some history. So, yeah, I mean, this is, to me, this is like the right move, if you will. Let's do that. Let's run right through to the Magneto. This is electrifying the Easter Jeep Safari. I'm just going to read the headline here. Zach, I'll toss it over to you. This, I think, is a really obvious and cool thing to do. The more electric they can make the Wrangler and the sooner, I think, is just the right move.
Yeah, you know, this was one of the, I think, four or five Easter Jeep concepts that Jeep revealed, but arguably the fully electric Magneto is the most interesting one. And it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be either. Really, the big surprise to me is like how similar they wanted to make this versus just a standard Wrangler. It has a 6-speed manual transmission, and it's an electric Jeep, which is sort of cool. I've seen manual transmission electric cars before. It's not a ton of reason for them other than them just being cool. And they also match the horsepower and torque to the Pentastar V6, you know, just for consistency's sake, it seems. You know, this isn't like, I guess, a new battery electric vehicle platform or anything. They literally just took a Wrangler, took all of the engine exhaust stuff out, and stuffed in batteries where they could. And they found, you know, a big enough spot for 70 kilowatt hours worth of battery. That's cool for a concept. I'm assuming that whenever we do get an electric Wrangler, if we do anytime soon, it'll definitely be bigger than that with more range. But just the idea of, you know, an electric Wrangler being thrown out there by Jeep is super intriguing to me. You know, they've been throwing a whole lot of stuff at the wall ever since the Bronco came out. You know, they're like instantly Wrangler 4xe, Wrangler 392, you know, just making a lot of noise where, well, Jeep hasn't made a whole lot of noise for a while because it's just another Wrangler that, of course, everybody's going to buy the Jeep because, well, there's nothing else to buy. So yeah, super intriguing. I know, I would be very interested in an electric Jeep. I'm sure Green editor John Snyder would also. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
I think it's exactly the right move for them. You know, they're sort of taking steps towards a more electric future with Jeep, and I think this is logical. And I think, Zach, you laid out how they sort of packaged it all up, and I think what they did was quite clever. You know, it's, some of these Easter Jeep Safari concepts are pure fiction, and some of them actually have like forward-looking applications. So I'll be interested to see if this does preview how they're going to electrify the Wrangler, if you will. So that's the Magneto. Let's keep it in the company formerly known as FCA. That's Stellantis. I wrote an opinion piece this week. Look for opinion pieces from the Autoblog editors, a few of our, you know, friendly freelance types, many names you know and recognize. We're going to run those probably on Wednesdays. But I kicked things off with a piece saying it was basically the case for Chrysler, why I think Stellantis needs Chrysler. And I kind of approached it from two fronts. One is from a marketing perspective, if you kill Chrysler, people think you might be closing the company. They might. At best, they might be confused. At worst, they might think everything went under. Stellantis, I think, is a corporate like shell name that I would bet you guys a beer there's a different name in 10 years. I don't think Stellantis will continue. And my second point was that product-wise, you've got a premium brand there that you could use. And you shouldn't waste an opportunity to like make higher profit margins, appeal to a different crowd that maybe is a little more affluent than some Dodge buyers and Jeep buyers. The commenters went crazy. We had like 50 comments as of this morning, and I haven't even looked since. So I'm kind of You know, and at least a couple of them suggested that, like, GMC and Buick, you know, GMC is the truck brand, a la Jeep. Buick is more of the premium brand. Could be a playbook here for Stellantis. Tossed over to you there, Zach. You agree, disagree, neutral? What do you think?
I agree with pretty much everything in your column here. You know, if they make Chrysler into, you know, sort of a Lincoln-ish type thing, don't make them Buick, because Buick, you know, as much as they try to be cool, they are still not that cool of a brand in most people's eyes. It has not worked. But, you know, make something like the Lincoln Aviator plug-in hybrid, just like you suggested. I think it's an awesome idea. You know, make it different from the Jeep. You know, whereas the Grand Cherokee L and the Grand Cherokee, you know, very Jeep-like, off-road-esque design, you know, make this one more car-like, you know, and just really, really spice up all of the luxury treatments. I know there were a few really good ideas in the Slack channel yesterday that I was rereading. Art Deco, you know, find your niche. Don't try and copy somebody else, but find your own niche and give us a couple really good cars. And, you know, going the green way, I think, works, because Chrysler, FCA, Stellantis, whatever you want to call them, they don't have anything in that space right now, and they could really, really use some help there. And making Chrysler that beacon of green seems like a path forward for the company.
Yeah, I mean, there's some low-hanging fruit, which my point was take a Jeep, slap a Chrysler badge on it, style it a little bit differently, different interior. I mean, Ford, Lincoln, the playbook is there. Do that. That's easy. And immediately you're going to make more money and have more volume for Chrysler. Yeah, electrification, I think, makes a ton of sense, too, because you can charge more for an electric Chrysler, or at least a little bit more than you can for maybe an electric Dodge. So we'll see. I mean, they have the the Pacifica is a great minivan. You know, they've got that. The 300 is still pretty good. It's just really old and they haven't updated it. But it's the same thing as the Charger and essentially the Challenger, and those cars are doing well. So it, you know, maybe that segment is saturated, but I mean, literally Chrysler has the same car that is like all but disappearing. So it seems like if they put in the work, they could make that thing more competitive. And then what do you do? So thoughts, James?
Well, I have two main things. One is I think their goal needs to be more Buick than Cadillac and Lincoln. Now, they can do better than Buick has, arguably, although I don't know if Buick really... I mean, we're not unexcited about Buick, but some of their cars actually sell pretty well. But just because Chrysler is not on the same level as Cadillac and Lincoln, even though, like, the Lincoln name was, you know, was, as you know, was geriatric, really, with town cars and everything, but they have a lot more brand cachet left over than Chrysler has. It was always more of a luxury brand than Chrysler was. Chrysler had Imperial for that, and Chrysler over the years, for like my entire lifetime, if it was, I guess they had the New Yorker, but like really in terms of anyone, like most people's memory, that's not anywhere close to a luxury brand. Not when you're selling just a Chrysler Cirrus is the kind of the same as a Dodge Stratus. A Town and Country is the same as a Grand Caravan, but it has some wood on the dash. Like they so cratered the value of their brand as anything premium. Like they can only go so high with that. So I think Buick would be a more logical, at least, goalpost in terms of luxury adjacent premium, whatever you want to call it. The other thing is, we can talk about electric, but where is that platform coming from? That's something they need to develop from scratch, because it's Stellantis, which means that they're now in bed with Peugeot Citroën. They have electric cars. They exist. They are small European city cars and front or and you know, small SUVs. That ain't a Chrysler 300 replacement. So, do they have the capital and desire to do that? That's a question. I don't know. I don't think we want to see a Citroen C whatever with a Chrysler badge on it. That would be bad. So, you know, I agree. I mean, part of the reason you can't get rid of Chrysler is because, like, generically the company is called Chrysler. So how do you get rid of that? But at least there's a couple of things they have at their advantage. There's not like, there's not really like GM had, where they just had Chevy dealer and an Oldsmobile dealer and a Buick dealer. They, everything's already under a great, great big roof. So if you just sell one Chrysler, that's kind of okay because it's all in the same dealer as the Dodge and the Jeep and the Ram. So there's less of a concern about having some sort of all-encompassing brand. But, you know, they kind of have to figure out what they want to do with it. And I'm not sure we know the answer. And but the things you suggested are obviously the way to go. You need to big SUV. How nice it goes, I don't know. But, you know, if the Grand Wagoneer is pretty off-roady, you can have something that's totally different direction. It is more Lincoln Aviator, even if it's not quite to that expense and opulence. So, yeah, I agree with you, but I am throwing some, you know, cautionary, what are they going to do about that?
Sounds good. I think the Chrysler Aspen was a name, if I recall, that might work for that SUV, which they literally built for like 5 years. They just gave up on it because it was a Durango that didn't sell too well. You know, they've had some missteps. You know, I don't disagree with you that they've done about as much as they can outside of the Pacifica to really just let the brand kind of go out the pasture. I mean, there's an argument that Chrysler right now is, I don't want to give it quite the Oldsmobile like comparison, because I do think the Pacifica minivan is great, even though it is similar to the Caravan and whatnot. But I mean, General Motors somewhat paid attention to Oldsmobile right up until they killed it. Now, the last 5 years, they didn't. But I mean, there were new cars like throughout the 90s that were somewhat good. So I would agree with you that Chrysler has a lot of work to do. And I think, yeah, we'll see. It's been a fun thought starter that people have a lot of ideas, that's for sure. Yeah, should we spend some money?
I always like doing that.
Let's do it. All right. So first we have an update. This is from a couple podcasts ago. I believe it was the last time you were on, Zach specifically. This is from James Ty, who says, thanks for answering the question about the Lyft. Great to hear from someone with extensive experience. Just for our benefit, the reason he didn't ask about what car to get was because after listening to the Autoblog podcast and many podcasts for years, he's already decided on getting a Miata. So that's problem solved right there. Or he might go with a Cayman, which I'd probably say Cayman, but hey, you know, it's good. I think he knows what we would probably say here. And good job there, Zach. You educated James here on the Lyft. And he is doing what you're going to do.
So. I am always happy to sing the praises of Lyfts.
All right. Sounds good.
Awesome.
Let's spend some money this week. This one comes from Rhett, who is looking for a sub $15,000 Overlander and Enthusiast combo. So we kind of were trying to figure out what exactly, specifically, 15 grand for both or 15 grand for each. We've decided to essentially answer the question is 15 grand, literally as it's written as a combo. So the question is, say 15 grand or lower, what used vehicles would you choose to replace a 2001 S2000 and a 2013 Honda Fit? You would like an off-road capable vehicle and another fun manual to drive for himself and his wife. Picks are something like a CR-V, and a GTI. Some of the other criteria, he's trying to balance reliability, enjoyment, fuel economy, and practicality all at once. This is why he loves his S2000 that has zero options. Simplicity, I'd love to keep it till I die. He sighs. Looking forward to hearing what you suggest. I'm going to give half my answer right now, which is there's some facts that are not offered in evidence here, such as why Rhett wants to get rid of the S2000. But after scanning the used car listings, there's some interesting things, and it's always a fun exercise to shop, but I think I would probably suggest to keep the S2000. With that, I'm going to throw it around the horn to you, Zach.
Yeah, I will say exactly what you said, to keep the S2000. For that amount of money, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to buy an S2000 in any decent shape for around $15,000. As for the Overlander thing, I would recommend one of the cars that I've actually personally been looking into a lot over the past year or two, which is the first-gen RAV4. You mentioned that you want a manual. You can get that in a manual. You can get it with all-wheel drive. The all-wheel drive system is very cool because it was derived from the Celica All-Track, which itself was derived from a rally car. So those are some very cool things to have. And you can get it in two doors or four doors. I'm guessing that you'll want it in four doors because sounds like you want a little bit of utility in your life beyond the sports car. But if you really want to get rid of that S2000, I would totally replace it with a different two-door sports convertible with a Boxster. And I just buy as much Porsche Boxster for the money that you can sell your S2000 for if you really are intent on getting rid of that S2000. That said, I would still keep the Honda. So those are my, I guess, 2/3 picks to go for.
All right, over to you, James.
So I would be somewhat like Zach. So I'm not going original RAV4. I'm going with this third generation RAV4. That would be the last one with the swing gate. And I would get it with the V6. And you should definitely get it with the V6. I say this in terms of back when it was new, I did a comparison test with that and the third generation CRV. So that was the first flip up tailgate CRV. And it was just far more capable off-road than a CRV. The CRV kind of has a pretty simple, very reactive all-wheel drive system. Like, you need the wheels to slip a lot and then it kicks in. That's not what you're going to want when you're actually doing off-roading. Whereas the RAV4 has a far more impressive, that RAV4 has a far more impressive all-wheel drive system. It has a lock on it. And in that comparison test, the RAV4 was far more capable than the CRV. It's also a lot bigger than the one that Zach mentioned. It grew quite a lot. My neighbors have that car, and they go camping and sleep in the back of that thing quite a lot. So in terms of reliability, enjoyment, fuel economy, practicality, which were all elements that Rhett mentioned, plus his budget, I'd say that would be his best bet. You can, assuming that he only has 15 grand for both of these, you can get one with not that terrible, 80 to 120,000 miles on it for like $7,000 to $8,000 with the V6, with all-wheel drive. I think that would be your best bet. For the fun car, that would leave you with $7,000 to $8,000 to spend. I don't know how the answer isn't Miata. I'd be a little concerned with an $8,000 GTI. Might be kind of unreliable and expensive at that price point, kind of beaten up. So I don't know. And maybe just keep the Fit too, because that's kind of a fun car if it has a manual on it. So I'd kind of keep that. Maybe if you want to just be totally weird, you can find an MR2 Spider and keep it all a Toyota choice. But I'm guessing, if I had to guess why he's selling the S2000, he's selling that to be able to buy two cars with it. And you wouldn't have the money for the bigger thing if you didn't sell the S2000. So that would be my guess there. But in terms of the inexpensive thing, maybe you could find a cool old Mustang or something for $8,000. But again, if I don't see what the I don't see how the answer isn't Miata.
That you literally took the words out of my mouth there, James, because I was literally looking at cool old Mustangs for like $8,000 here on a couple different sites. Maybe cool and old isn't the necessary how I would splice this all together. But I mean, you could get a like an 08 GT. That's maybe not super old, but it was actually kind of a cool generation as I look back in hindsight. They're anywhere from like $7,000 to like $12,000, which could be a fun toy car. So that's like part of the equation.
Oh, I have one.
Yeah.
I'm sitting in it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
BMW Z3.
The Autoblog Podcast Studio West.
You can absolutely get a
West.
Decent one. Yeah. You can absolutely get a decent one. It has a six-cylinder engine, manual transmission, actually decent room in it for a roadster, a lot more spacious than a Miata of the time, more comfortable, more powerful. I've had one, and although I don't drive it a lot, which is probably why it's been kind of reliable, knock on wood trim, great car. That's what I'm going with. Z3 and third generation RAV4 V6.
Okay.
Boom.
All right. Z3, third gen. All right. I have found a couple of 4Runners. Here's an 02 that you could get for $6,500. So you could get that and maybe a Mustang of, you know, a couple years newer. So that could be, if you're looking to change it up, go with a 4Runner and get a Mustang. And you're definitely, you know, pivoting away from like some of your Honda loyalties. But these aren't expensive cars. You can flip it in a couple more years, flip one, flip the other. So that's what I would probably do is get, you know, basically throw in the, you know, your favorite car finder thing, like the Autoblog car finder, and see how many miles you're willing to take and balance it out as far as, you know, the cost. You know, you could get like I said, an 08-ish Mustang. I've got one here for about $7,000 in Oklahoma City. You could do that. If you want to spend all of the money or most of the money, you could scroll up, if you will, and get like a Mustang with only 52,000 miles on it for $14,000. Okay, there you go. Make it a one car budget thing. Or my, I guess, suggestion is Mustang and then go with the 4Runner. Let me see if I can find a good one. I did find, I have to say this, even though I don't think I do this, a 1992 Mercedes 300 coupe. It's got 187,000 miles on it in private seller unlisted locations. There's a lot of things about this I probably wouldn't do, but it's a cool car. So if you're looking to, I would say, drop $7,500, that's probably what you're doing with that option there. But I came across it and it's fun. A Miata and a Boxster are two of the other obvious sports car ones, but to be different, I'll go with Mustang. And then let me see if I can find the 4Runner I was looking at. Okay, here's one with 221,000 miles, $65,000. Yeah, it's got some miles on it, James.
Yeah. And I tell you, the RAV4 V6, that'll be a lot quicker than a 4Runner.
That's true, but he's looking for an Overlander, not a, you know.
But if he mentions the CRV. Yeah.
That's true. It's true.
I don't know how severe of overlap. I don't know what land he's going over.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, here's an 88 4Runner with a snorkel on it. So, but that's $15,000.
He can go over. He can go over water.
Through water. Underwater, partially, if he wants to.
Overwatering.
So, all right. Hey, that's my answer. Mustang 4Runner. Yeah. That's what we'll do there. This is a long show, guys.
If we're throwing out, you know, 90s Mercedes and whatnot, I'll throw out the Isuzu Trooper as a potential overlander. I know that doesn't hit your fuel economy, probably not reliability either.
Right, right.
If you want something fun.
Make it an Acura SLX.
Oh, or that.
And it's within the Honda family.
It is.
There you go.
I was going to say, it's been a while since we've gone off the rails on a spend my money where we have the criteria and then we essentially take the criteria as a muse and then just riff on whatever the hell we want to talk about, which is how you end up with 88 Mercedes two doors and other things. Final thoughts on anything, guys? When you've gone this long, if you're still listening at this point, you probably would like to hear whatever we're thinking about at this point. Any thoughts, gentlemen?
I'm looking forward to driving. I have to drive this 4Runner this afternoon. I'm looking forward to it because it is bringing it back to early on. Love the 4Runner.
I guess we'll be living the Toyota truck life, both of us, this week, James. Have to find some cool places to take them off-road. I don't know where, but that's what's on my mind.
I'll be getting in the Mini Countryman later this week, and, you know, this podcast has given me many thoughts to ponder as I drive. So with that, send your questions to podcast@autoblog.com. It's been fun hanging out with you guys this week. Until next time, everybody be safe out there.